Good morning and welcome to WRCO's WRCE's morning show. This morning is our monthly visit with Senator Howard Markline, and today we have Assembly Representative Todd Novak with us. And Senator Markline, it's been a month since you've been here, and a lot has been going on as far as the state budget and other things, hasn't it?
It sure has. When I was here last, we hadn't passed the shared revenue bill. That was passed like 2 weeks, I think, before the budget was passed. And then also, of course, the state budget, you know, was passed out of my committee and Joint Finance Committee, and then went to the legislature and passed and has been signed into law. So, yeah, a lot of stuff's happened, you know, and the shared revenue bill is... I know it's gotten a lot of media attention. The impact on every one of our cities, counties, villages, townships is significant. And I've got all the numbers here. I can cite every one of every community in my district and the increase that they're going to get, and it's huge.
That was a big ask from county administrators and township, everyone, wasn't it?
Oh, sure, And I got to give a lot of credit to Representative Tony Kurtz. I mean, I think it was back in September last year is when Representative Kurtz and State Senator Mary Felskowski started working on this whole thing. And it took them almost a year because it started out shared revenue has been frozen basically for decades now. And, you know, it needed to go up. And so they started working on this, like I said, last September or so. And then about in January, I believe, is when this whole issue, and it doesn't really affect us out here at all, but the Milwaukee County and the Milwaukee City pension problem kind of surfaced. And basically, City of Milwaukee especially, they were heading for bankruptcy, you know, if they didn't deal with their pension problem. So that kind of got tucked into that bill as well. And there was all kinds of meetings. I was involved with a whole bunch of those meetings with the City of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. And it's important, you know, I don't know that any one of us, I don't think it's a good for any city in our state to go bankrupt. Especially your biggest city, you know, it's just not a good image to have. So we got that resolved as well. And last week, the Milwaukee Common Council voted to approve the 2% increase in their sales tax. So it doesn't affect us out here. if Phil Nee goes to a Brewers game, then he may have to pay the extra 2% in sales tax to the city or to the City of Milwaukee. But you know, for anybody out here, it doesn't affect us at all.
Now, you know, how does that work that cities can raise their, do they have to get permission from the state to raise their city sales tax?
Yes, they do.
So, and is there increments that they're allowed to do it? Or?
Well, we have a few communities in the state that are, it's called the Premier Resort Area Tax, the PRAT. The Wisconsin Dells is the classic case. Because when you look at a city like Wisconsin Dells, it's probably got a population of 2,800 people, you know, residents that live there. Well, I don't know what the population of Wisconsin Dells is on a weekend, but in the summertime, but it's huge. So they're permitted to increase, and they have increased their sales tax because they've got to support fire, police, all kinds of services that go far beyond a community of 2,800 people. So we do have a number of those communities around the state that with legislation from the state permits them to have the premier resort area tax.
And that's basically seen sales only so that the tourists help pay for the necessary first responders and all of those things.
Exactly. So, and I don't know what the Dells, their rate is now, but it's, you know, it's probably, you know, an additional 6-7%. And, you know, when you, you know, when we travel, if you travel, you know, go to Chicago, for example, if you ever stay or have a meal in Chicago or, you know, I mean, their taxes down there are incredible. You know, it's, and nobody, you don't blink an eye, you know, it's just part of the cost. And I think for many of the visitors to the Dells, I think it's probably the same thing. I think, you know, when they rent their room and it's $150 a night, they don't blink that it's going to be an extra 10% or whatever on top of that for local taxes.
Well, I think the last time I did eat in Illinois, it was like 10% sales tax. And I'm sure when people come from out of state, they don't blink an eye about paying a higher sales tax.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so the going back to Milwaukee, again, the city tax, and that was approved last week. So that's, you know, going to happen probably on January 1st is when that rate goes into effect. And it takes several months for the Department of Revenue to make the necessary adjustments, which will happen this fall, and in order for it to go into effect on January 1st. And I think the county, the Milwaukee County Board, will be voting sometime here, probably in the next month. And that would be a countywide sales tax increase of 0.4%.
And then will they see that the results of that in with the first quarter?
Yeah, the and I'm not sure when the settlement, how often the city in the Milwaukee their settlement is with the, but yeah, it's going to, you know, and the. They wanted to get this thing done too for a number of reasons. Number one is, and I've talked to the police union and the firefighters union, and you know they're facing huge layoffs if they don't. If the city was looking at hundreds and hundreds of police officers getting fired, the police union was they're looking at closing a number of fire stations if this thing hadn't passed. So the bulk of this money, the huge majority of this money, is going to go to fix their pension problem in both the city and the county. And again, the problem is they have their own pension system. They don't participate in the Wisconsin retirement system like every teacher or county, any other government employee in the state of Wisconsin. They have their own, and they've had it for years. And the Milwaukee City and County pension system covering their police and fire, I describe it as very poorly designed and very poorly funded. Okay? Now, when you combine those two, it's not a good, whereas the state retirement system is wonderfully designed, a very, very well designed system, and we funded it, and which is unlike what's happened in Milwaukee.
Is there a chance ever that the state could say, you know, you need to move to the state pension plan?
That's part of the deal, is that all new hires, we call it a soft close, all new hires. So if you're a new firefighter coming in or a new police officer getting hired in Milwaukee, you will automatically now be enrolled in the state retirement system. Okay. And so, you know, over time, this old retirement, this legacy Milwaukee City, Milwaukee County retirement system is going to go away, and all employees will be in the same program that, again, every teacher and county employee is enrolled in for the rest of the state.
Now, we've been talking about Milwaukee, but there was some good results locally for the new budget, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and I, you know, again, after the dust settled, you know, with the governor signing the budget and all that, I was able to kind of go back and kind of reflect on some of the things that are in the budget, you know. And, you know, when I think of healthcare, for example, you know, the we increased funding for our hospitals significantly. And I've got nine community hospitals from, you know, Boscobel, Richland Center, Hillsborough, Dodgeville. You know, we've got Todd and I were at a groundbreaking and yesterday, or it was 2 days ago in Darlington for their new hospital. So funding for our hospitals is going to go up. Nursing homes, another area that and they've been hurting through this COVID, you know, issue, you know, in the last few years. And we increased the funding for our nursing homes by $195 million. So I know I've heard from local nursing home administrators, how happy they are with the additional funding that they're going to get. Transportation, I believe it was just an outstanding transportation budget, especially for local roads. We included, there's a part of the local road budget is a new program, and I got to give Representative Travis Tranel a lot of credit on this. We call it the AREP, the Agriculture Road Improvement Program. $150 million, one-time money, dedicated to the town roads that they don't qualify for any federal funding. You know, those are these town roads that we live on that milk trucks have to travel on, you know, feed deliveries and all that, they get posted in the spring. And so, you know, they're weight restricted. So the $150 million is going to go for those small local Class B highways that we've got all kinds of them out here. But that's great. And then, you know, we kept all the funding, all the projects on schedule for this biennium. So, it was an excellent transportation budget. Now, having said that, the downside is that the governor, we provided an increase in GTA, general transportation aids, across the board for cities, counties, villages, and our townships. For some reason, the governor vetoed the GTA increase for our townships. And so that was $10 million that he vetoed. And I know that our towns, the town officials I've talked to, they're not very happy, you know, that they were singled out for some reason for not getting their increase in their GTA. So, you know, I mean, when I look at is the glass half empty or half full? The half full part says overall it was a pretty darn good transportation budget. I don't know why we would have targeted those townships for a cut. But the income tax cut, you know, I was very supportive of that. We had a surplus coming into the budget, and we provided a significant income tax cut across the board, every bracket, and the governor vetoed the top two rate cuts. So that means that anybody which cut the tax cut, anybody making over $36,000 a year, so which is the vast majority of the people in my district and vast majority of the people around the state. So that was disappointing. I thought he was going to veto the top bracket, but that third bracket, I was kind of surprised that he vetoed that. So that was disappointing. But all in all, here in Richland County, we were able to get over $4 million to complete County O. That's been on the drawing board here for a long, long, long time. And, you know, and I'm trying to think back of how many different highway commissioners we worked with on that. But Josh Elder was persistent. I got to give Josh a lot of credit. And we were able to provide funding in the budget for that. So I'm happy that that's, you know, finally, that project's finally going to get done.
Yeah. He actually sent a press release last week. And it's hard to believe that that project, excuse me, has been on the board since 2004.
Yeah. Yeah, it precedes me. And part of the challenge there is so much of the upfront design work, the, you know, planning, engineering, that's a sunk cost that the county had funded, you know, a long time ago. So, you know, if we hadn't gotten this money for County O, it would have been, well, unfortunate not getting a project done, but there would have been a lot of these costs that would have been for nothing that were incurred in the past.
Well, and it's kind of interesting, though, they were able to come up with funding in other areas to at least get parts of it done at different times. This, though, will complete the project.
Yep. And again, the cheapest two segments, phase one and phase three, were the smallest dollar amounts, and those did get funded and completed. And it was this larger phase two that was sitting out there and needed to get done.
So you have some other good news, though, for Richland County residents, too, don't you, as far as the shared revenue?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. You know, again, shared revenue, and it's not just Richland County. It's every one of my communities, every one of my counties. And, you know, when I look, you know, well, at Richland County, for example, and shared revenue is the money that comes from the state back to our villages, cities, townships, and the county. And when I look at Richland County collectively, all of the municipalities here and the county, the shared revenue is going to go up by almost $2 million, okay, per year. That's a 53% increase in the shared revenue for the whole county, okay? City of Richland Center, that's going up almost $300,000. Richland County portion of that is going up by $800,000, over $800,000. So, again, these are significant, you know, increases. Again, everyone, our town of Richland is going up 132%. Village of Lone Rock's going up, you know, $44,000. So, and this is all money that they can use to fund, you know, local services, EMS, police and fire. So, I'm just happy that we got that done. The other good part about this is that this is now tied to the sales tax collections for the state. Okay. And so the numbers that I just cited are not fixed. They're going to go up or down, probably up with the sales tax collections in the state. So if sales tax collections go up 4%, kind of tied to inflation, then the revenue to our local communities will go up by 4% in the future. So they got some cushion built in there, some inflationary cushion built into this program.
Now, the shared revenue hadn't really kept up with inflation, had it, for years.
No.
This is the first time it's gone up in a long time.
And I think decades, probably.
Yeah. Now, Todd Novak's with us today, and Todd, you are the mayor of Dodgeville, right? So this really, as a state representative, you see it one way, but you also see it another way as a mayor.
Yeah, and I can't remember what we got for an increase. We're on the lower end of shared revenue anyway, just because of the valuation of our city. But, you know, this has been a long journey, as Howard alluded to, and we first originally started talking in the assembly, at least, about increasing shared revenue last summer. We had a meeting, and I thank Tony Kurtz so much for leading this charge. And then the shared revenue bill was held in my committee. I was chair of local government, and I think it's the longest hearing I ever had. It was about 7 hours. It was really fun. I did not think we'd ever get this. There were times when I'm like, we're never going to get this done. And it wasn't the shared revenue. I think everybody in unison was in agreement that we needed to increase shared revenue to the municipalities. However, the Milwaukee piece kind of messed. Sticking the Milwaukee piece in there really kind of clogged it up a little bit. And but overall, it is fantastic. I'm hearing from communities all over my district, as Howard is with his, that are very excited. This has been frozen. Oh, I can't even remember how many years. But what I really like, too, is that it's set. We don't have to worry every 2 years we do a budget how much we're going to increase in shared revenue. Tying it to the sales tax, it's fantastic because it'll automatically increase when sales tax increases and everything. I was just, Howard and I were at the Lafayette County Fair this weekend, and I ran into a village president from a municipality in Lafayette County. And they went to referendum last November to keep their EMS because they were running, struggling funding it. And it failed. And he came up to me at the fair and he said, thank you guys so much. He goes, because of the extra increase in shared revenue we're getting, we're going to be able to keep things moving. And I'm hearing that all over. So, and overall, you know, it was a good budget, as Howard said. A little problem. I have some issues with the vetoes. But we put a lot of funding. I have been around long enough, not as long as Howard, but around long enough where I've had budgets to deal with that had no money. And you're sitting there, what can we do here to this one with the surplus? But sometimes I'm not quite sure. When you have that much money, I would say, and Howard probably knows this, you know, we had around $7 billion surplus, probably had $50 billion in requests to spend it. So it wasn't the easiest to figure out. But overall, I'm very happy with this budget. The roads projects in there, as Howard said, we've also, in the lower portion of Howard Senate District and my district, there's projects going right now that Howard and I put in the budget, what, 2-3 years ago, Highway 39, the Lone Rock Bridge, that we had moved up that are now being funded and moving along. And so it's really, I know people get upset about road construction during the time, but it's really nice to see. If you drive around, very seldom will you not run into some road construction.
So overall, for a small community, you know, this is a plus.
Yeah, it is a plus. And, you know, I'm kind of the local government guru, and I've been doing this so long, and that's always been the one number thing that I've heard about from municipalities since I've been in office, is we need an increase in shared revenue. Also, I believe the funding for schools is pretty good, even though I will hear that it's not enough, because that's just the standard that you always hear. We did some stuff there, and, you know, how hospitals, nursing homes, Howard said. And I would say that bar his vetoes that I'm still trying to figure out, we did a really good budget this year. And the governor, to his credit, did negotiate the shared revenue, school funding, which he kind of went back on. So it was, you know, he was in the room for a lot of this. So
I'm hearing, you know, a good budget, good shared revenue, but it still leaves money for a rainy day fund.
I believe we have $4 billion now with his vetoes. And
we have, after he... the veto. We just got a fiscal bureau memo last week. We will end the biennium with a surplus of $4 billion plus a rainy day fund of $1.8 billion.
All right. Well, I think on that note, we'll take a break and be back in just a few moments. Welcome back to the morning show on WRCO, WRCE. I'm Joanne Krulatz, filling in for Phil Nee, who has a much-needed vacation. And we are here today with Senator Howard Markline and Assembly Representative Todd Novak. And we've been discussing, you know, shared revenue, the budget, and the good things about them and the bad things about them. But overall, it seems to be a pretty good consensus that overall it's good for counties and districts and the state as a whole, maybe not so good for persons, the, you know, individuals themselves, as far as the tax bracket and the possibility of raised property taxes with the governor's increase in property taxes for the next 400 years. I know that kind of opens up a can of worms, but when I first saw that, I thought 400 years, it's a long time. Did he just kind of change the number a little bit? And
you know, it's clear what he did. He just crossed out a couple of digits and a dash, and added. It basically became a 400-year tax increase. So maybe Todd will be around then, but I know I won't be. But that was just kind of disingenuous. I think There is nobody that you know, both sides of the aisle or whatever that believes that, you know, a 400-year commitment or is even appropriate. I mean, to make, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. I was just, I don't know. You know, again, Todd mentioned this a little bit ago, you know, that there was negotiations on that. This is part of that shared revenue agreement and stuff. And I'm pretty sure that the legislative leaders did not even talk about a 400-year commitment to increase property taxes down the road.
Now, though, this is tied to the biennial budget, which only goes to 2025. So in 2025, it can be changed, can't it?
You can't bind a future legislator and governor unless it's a constitutional amendment. And, you know, on this veto here, the 400-year times frame, I've had people say to me, well, why did you guys write the budget so he could do that? He can't. I mean, that's my firm belief, legally, he can't. And I'm sure somewhere along the line it'll be challenged, but we can change it in 2 years. I don't know if it was more of a political statement or what it was, but you're talking a huge, huge property tax increase. And I know as I talk to people, property taxes are a huge issue with them. And I'm just not sure what he was thinking. And again, I'll go back to the deal I said before. I mean, I know people may have a hard time believing this in the legislature, but we have split government and a handshake's a handshake. And that's kind of the rule when you come to a deal. And this is part of the education and shared revenue agreement we had with him. And for him to do this just kind of makes you wonder, you know, what's going to happen in the next 6 months? Will we be able to trust him? Because I know he wants to work on another tax cut, which he should have just left the one in there. But so I don't know if that's going to happen. There's different things he vetoed he wants to now all of a sudden negotiate on. And, you know, Howard can attest to this. We went through this last time. We eliminated the personal property tax in the budget 2 years ago, and then he vetoed it and then came out with the same pretty much exact language he vetoed. And sometimes it just baffles you, but that's politics. And we'll see what happens with this. Even the school, I've had school superintendents will not publicly tell me this, but say that they just can't believe that he did this too. So I think it was just a political statement. Every government, a governor, even Governor Walker was here, they kind of put a little political statements in their budget when they present it, and, you know, and we get to take it out and the veto process. So,
but then, you know, with, like you said, as far as the tax, you know, he vetoed that for $36,000 up to $400,000, that, you know, all we're going to save is $36. But then he also added this property tax on. So it's basically a wash. We're not going to gain anything, are we?
Yeah, $36 tax cut. And Harkin knows his tax cut stuff back of his hand. But I expected him to veto the top tax bracket. I fully expected it just by his language. But that middle one that affects probably 70% of the public just kind of really baffles me. And, you know, you're saving $36, and I'm just still scratching my head at that one, too. I'm not sure why that, I mean, we've got the money. It's the people's money, and this is one thing I think the difference in our philosophy versus the governor's is I firmly believe this is the people's money. It's not our money, and so I think that's the philosophical difference between the two of us.
Do you think, like, you have $4 billion, let's put it at $4 billion because it was $7 billion, do you run into some people who are happy that we still have that for future expenses that may crop up, or are the majority saying that's our money and we want it back?
You know, when you look at why we have had a surplus and have a surplus, that was largely due to an incredible amount of federal money, one-time federal money coming into the state. That's the PPP loans businesses got. That's the payments that individuals got, money that went to counties, to hospitals, to airports. I mean, I think it was somewhere in the area of $65 billion of one-time money dropped into the state of Wisconsin. And that filtered its way through the economy, okay? And it resulted in inflation, shocking. Wages were going up and all that. And it also resulted in, with inflation, the prices of goods and services went up, okay? Which is why our sales tax went up 10%. We did not sell 10% more stuff, okay? The prices went up 7, 8, 9, 10% or more, you know, depending upon what you're buying. So anyway, a lot of that surplus that we had going into this budget cycle was one-time money from taxes that people paid extra, okay, on stuff. And so, you know, and Todd mentioned this earlier, we've got needs. You know, their inflation hit the state of Wisconsin too. It hit workers. Our costs have gone up. We need to fund that stuff. But largely, that is taxpayer money that I believe a significant part of that ought to be returned to the taxpayers. And this idea of letting it sit around, I mean, and I've had a couple people, you know, say, well, we ought to build a foundation and whatever. It's like, are you kidding me? To increase taxes, to have it sit someplace else? I'd rather have that money in people's pockets. You make better decisions about how to spend your money, I think, than government does. And that's a general statement. But even like the federal level, you know, the further we get away from our local communities, you know, people make smart decisions with their money at kitchen tables, you know, and I trust that. And that's where I believe, you know, the bulk of that surplus ought to go is back to the taxpayers. I'm very comfortable looking ahead. And I spent a lot of time when we did the budget about what's our structural situation going to be down the road. So, you know, 2 years from now, we're going to have to do another budget, you know. And I don't want to be in a situation where we're hurting. I was very comfortable with the budget that we passed that we would not have any issues going into the next budget cycle.
Are you comfortable with budgets at two-year frameworks, or should it be annual? Should it be a little longer?
You know, if you do it every year, I mean, Todd's a mayor, and you know, when you do it every 2 years, or school districts especially, I think, you know, they need to plan more than 12 months out. I mean, their year started on July, their fiscal year started on July 1st as well. So, gosh, you know, I think 2 years is appropriate. I can't imagine going through this every year and having every school district, every tech college, every county, every city, you know, waiting to see what happened with the budget to figure out what they're going to do. You know, they, and I've heard this from, especially from school district administrators, is they'd like even more certainty out into the future so they can plan staffing levels and that sort of thing out into the future.
Now, you just said staffing levels, and we were kind of talking about, you know, businesses that are hurting because they can't get enough employees and they're raising their wages and everything. That was one good thing, too, that came out of this budget was that state workers will get an increase.
Yes, and, you know, again, it's an example of how inflation has hit, you know, the state of Wisconsin. And I've got the Boscobel prison, you know, is in my my district, as is the New Lisbon prison. A lot of state, you know, employees out here. And we were able to increase the compensation significantly for not just our correctional officers, but district attorneys, assistant district attorneys, public defenders, and the state patrol. They're all having problems with recruiting and retention of staff. So, and again, I think, you know, we're not that far from where we sit here from Boscobel, and I think of the officers down there. And so their minimum pay is going to go up, starting pay up to $33 an hour. Plus, there's going to be add-ons for vacancy rate, high vacancy rates. And so I think that's going to make that wage competitive. you know, there, I've talked to so many people that work in Boscobel or used to work in Boscobel, and you know, it's a tough situation. It's a tough clientele at the prison in Boscobel, and you know, you leave for your shift, your 8-hour shift, and you may not come home after 8 hours. You might get slammed and end up at 16 hours, and then you've got to come home, try to get a few hours of sleep before you go back again. And so it's a tough, and you're working, you know, it's a 24/7 facility, you know, so while some people are off on the weekend or off, you know, on a holiday, they're not.
Now, you know, not just the state, but small businesses and everything are having trouble staffing. What do you kind of see as the issue? Or, I mean, because it's not just local, it's not just state, it's national. And I know some of us baby boomers were retiring and the birth rate they had said declined. But, you know, where is everybody that we're closing restaurants at 3 p.m. because we can't get enough help? And maybe raising wages is one aspect, but a lot of businesses I've talked to, they've raised their wages and they still can't get the help.
No, I don't know. It's a head scratcher, and it's an issue that I hear about all the time from, you know, all employers. And it's not, you know, $7.25 is the minimum wage. There's nobody making $7.25 right now. Everybody's paying, you know, pretty good hourly wages to get people. I've run into you. We were talking before about, you know, in local governments. I'm running into problems in Dodgeville hiring. I've got open spots, and that's never happened because it's not exactly, you know, these are good jobs. And I can't figure it out. And then another thing that's happening, too, because I've been in these situations, and I'm hearing this a lot, is you'll interview somebody for a position, and you offer them the job at X amount of dollars. They go back to their employer, and they say, hey, I can go work for the city of Dodgeville for $28. They just offered me a job, and that employer immediately will match that. There's a lot of that going on, which is good. It's a competitive market. However, it's an interesting environment. You know, I was talking to one of the Quick Trip managers, which used to be it is the gold standard of pay and profit sharing and benefits, and there's some Quick Trips that are looking for people too, and it's just it's a head scratcher to me. So I just can't figure out where they are. And you're right, I'm the only one in this room not a baby boomer, by the way. But
rub it in.
The birth rate has gone down, you know, and we should have saw this coming. Declining enrollment in schools started how many years ago? So I think what is happening, and with COVID, we're feeling the effect of that shrinkage of the workforce.
Now, you brought up the fact that the minimum wage is $7.25, and it's been that, it seems like, forever. Mm-hmm. Do you foresee the state ever changing that, either of you?
I don't know. I mean, it's now, I mean, to me, in my mind, the minimum wage is $15, $16 an hour. Seriously. And, you know, I mean, we could change it, but to what? You know, as soon as we change it, then the next legislative session we're in, they're going to be screaming, you need to change it. And I just don't know anybody that's making $7.25. I really don't. So,
yeah, I heard somebody say that the average wage in Richland County is 15 something an hour. So it's like double what the state minimum wage is. But
well, what concerns me too is you're, and as somebody that is in a, you know, run a city. So when you hire somebody at a higher rate to get them, then you've got people that have worked there 10 or 15 years that are, the new person's making more than the old person. The person's been there. And then you have to make it equitable. And this happens a lot, too. In businesses, that's what they have to do. So, you know, in order to get somebody, you got to pay more. But then you also have to look at your existing staff and increase them. And I know a lot of companies are trying to do that, too. And they want to keep these people.
Yeah. I know, excuse me, almost 40 years ago, I kept telling my mom she needed to get a raise. And she goes, oh, no, no. Well, then she gave him a year's notice she was retiring. They couldn't find anybody to fill her position for what she was getting paid. So she finally got a raise her last year. You know, it was like...
Well, and then people tend not to stay in jobs as long as they used to be. When I was growing up, it didn't look good on your resume to have 6-7 jobs when you applied somewhere. And nowadays, that's just common. I'm hearing that from larger companies, your Lands End, your Swiss Colonies, or higher uppers, not higher uppers, you know, mid-managers. You know, they're sticking around a couple of years, and then they're moving on. And people are moving a lot, too. Not so much in the lower, and I don't mean lower class, but manual labor jobs and stuff like that, but as far as, you know, mid-management jobs.
Well, even education, you get teachers that move from, you know, for Pam Kintz to retire this year at 50 years, that's unheard of. For Phil's been here 37 years. I've been here 30 years. You don't hear that anymore, do you?
No. I mean, yeah, I mean, no, they used to be that way all the time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think I've got one teacher that taught me in grade school that's still living, and they were there for years, so.
Is there anything else that you want the listeners to know, or what's coming up next now that the budget has been finalized?
Well, we're kind of out of Madison for a while. I'm working on legislation that I want to do next after the budget, and it's dairy breakfasts are over. Howard and I are starting the fair circuit right now, which I would rather be doing what I'm doing right now with, for me personally, than be in Madison anyway. I know Howard's got to be up there more than I do, but so I'm catching up in district and going to places and visiting businesses, and you know, like I said, the fairs, we had a really good time on Saturday, and I bought a lamb, he bought a hog, and so we had a good day.
Well, I also saw a picture of Howard, and he was you know, working in one of the food booths, and so getting out there and rubbing elbows with the constituents.
Yep. So, and as Todd mentioned, last week I had two county fairs, Sauk in Lafayette, and then this week is Greene County, so I'll be heading down there later this week. Also, tomorrow starts Farm Technology Days, which is in Sauk County this year, so I'll be heading up there. I'll be volunteering for that. And I have no idea what the attendance is going to be, but it's a huge event, and there'll be farmers there from I'm guessing all over the Midwest coming to Sauk County. So I'm looking forward to that. And you know, like today, and I just follow up on what Todd said. I mean, now I just got a lot of stuff going on. I'll be out at County Highway O here in a little bit. Here I've got lunch with the sheriff, catch up with him, see how things are going. Tour Ellen Bradley at 12:30. I'm getting a meeting with the Department of Transportation to get a tour of the new bridge in Lone Rock. You get an update on the progress there. I'm on the Wisconsin State Fair Park Board now. I've got a State Fair Park Board meeting this evening, and you know, just a lot more activity in district, which is wonderful. I mean, there's just so many things going on, and I visited with some Farm Bureau members. Their Farm Bureau annual meetings are coming up, I think, starting next month. We got Towns Unit meetings coming up here. So just an awful lot of meetings in district, which that's the best part of my job.
Have you been going to any parades?
Not too many. I was so during the early part of the parade season, I was during the budget, and I had probably 6 to 8 inches of budget papers to read every weekend to get ready for the following week. So my weekends were pretty well booked with that. So I've got a bunch now on the schedule for the remainder of the summer.
All right. Todd, do you have anything else to add?
No. Like I said, I'm looking forward to the break, and not break, but just being in district with people. That's, as you can tell by both of our schedules, that's what we enjoy doing. And but it's going to go fast because I think we go back. Well, I got to go up next week for a couple things, but we'll be back in for too long. So it's amazing. Election cycles go so slow, but when you're actually in session, it goes so fast. So, yeah, it won't be too long, and we've got another 6-7 months left, and that'll be it.
Time for elections again. Seems like it's a never-ending circle, isn't it?
It really is, actually. So, but it's nice. I've been in, this will be my fifth term, and Howard had this, my assembly, in what, second term in Senate? So it's the third term in Senate. It's nice to be able to, you know, people come up to you and it's, you're approachable, they know you and they like talking about whatever, and I that's a part I enjoy. It's just like Saturday at the fair, I mean, just stood there and people were coming up, you know, talking, and of course rain was a big topic on Saturday, but that's the stuff I enjoy.
Yeah, I went to a program last week and they did a survey and they were asking, you know, do you get to talk to legislators? I'm like, I talk to mine all the time. But I think it is hard for some people to really get to know their legislators. And I think it's programs like this that help.
It does. You know, I mean, it takes me an hour to go to Walmart just to pick up a couple of things. And I like to be that. I want people to approach us. So it's Howard. And I like that.
All right.
It's also nice for talking about being approachable. You know, we get a chance to visit with a lot of school groups that tour the Capitol. And these are fourth graders, fifth graders generally. And it's so fun to connect with them and then to see them 3 months later at the fair or 3 months later, you know, and it's just, and I'll never forget this was in Belmont. I had lunch with the Belmont school district administrator. And at lunch, we're sitting in the cafeteria, and all these kids would come up and go, "Hello, Mr. Markline. Hello, Mr. whatever." And he's like, "How do you know all these kids?" And I said, "Well, they were at the Capitol, and then I was at the fair, and they were exhibiting at the Lafayette County Fair, and then they did a tour of the first Capitol historic site, and they invited me to come along, so I spent that day with them." So, you know, I spent a fair amount of time with the kids, and it was just wonderful, you know, to have that time with the kids and have a relationship with them.
I remember several years ago when I opened up my mailbox and there was an envelope and the return address was Senator Howard Markline. I'm like, why is he writing me? And I open it up and it was a newspaper article with my daughter's picture in it. I'm like, wow.
I think all legislators do that. We're very fortunate out here. I think I've got eight newspapers in my assembly district. People, I get that all the time. Thank you for the note. And how usually we write into the same people, depends on where the district is, but people really like that. And I've had kids, mothers tell me, "You sent my son when he was in high school, he won't let me take it off the refrigerator." And it's like, to me, I'm just like Todd. So, but I guess, you know, that means a lot to people, and wedding anniversaries, which, you know, so.
Well, it makes you more approachable. And that's why I'm a firm believer. If you do have an issue, if you have a problem, contact your local legislators. Yeah. That's what they're elected for.
And I think some people, when they contact us, I call them back. And they kind of shocked to actually hear from the actual legislator. I think a lot of people think they're going to deal with our staff and stuff. But if it's something that I can deal with, I'll call them myself.
Right.
And even, you know, I got a call last week from a constituent in Avoca. And they knew of somebody who had an issue, a passport issue. They wanted to travel for a family wedding and a passport had expired. Now, I've got nothing to do with passports, okay? But I know who can help. And so we made a couple phone calls and we got the issue resolved and got their passport taken care of. So again, even on stuff that, you know, my office may not be able to help directly, often we know who the right person is to contact to give them some assistance.
And I'll just add too that a lot of the bills that I've passed and Howard and I have passed together, I would say probably half of them have come from constituent contacts, issues in district, and I enjoy doing, and that's true. I wouldn't know about the idea if a constituent didn't call me or a municipal leader. And did you know this? And we've done quite a few bills, and you have with Tony and Travis Tranel too, and that's part of the job.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, and we'll see you next month.